HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents How Are You? Connection in a Virtual Age, A Therapist, a Pandemic, and Stories About Coping with Life by Teresa Rosenblatt, Ph.D. Read by Kelly Tager. Chapter 1. A New Context. What kind of fuckery is this? How are you? I rarely heard those three words in my work as a therapist before the pandemic. For close to a year, every single patient started their session this way. How the world changed for my patients and me. We lived through a societal crisis together on a grand scale. The deep impact of this shared experience changed the very nature of my work, from how I conduct therapy to the way I navigate the traditional boundaries between therapist and patient. The pandemic shook up the old order of things forever. I was challenged to rethink my practices, how I apply the analytical disciplines, theoretical framework, and theories of my rigorous training. The pandemic transformed my work, starting with my patient's first words. How are you? Pre-pandemic, patients normally plunged right into their own stories, as is the long-standing custom of therapy sessions. During the pandemic, my patients wanted to know how I was first. How was I weathering the storm? As much as we were living through a global trauma collectively, we were, each one of us, also alone. So many of our norms were challenged and rethought, both at the personal and the societal level. My patients knew that I was facing many of the same seismic shifts as they are. When they asked me, "How are you?" I wondered how I should answer. I am not a therapist who likes to answer a question with silence, yet I did not want a session to stray too far into personal territory, which can delay or obstruct the therapeutic benefits of focusing on a patient's experience. Pre-pandemic, I might have said, "Fine, thanks." Polite. Perfunctory. Then I would have listened for what the question meant to the patient. In the early days of the pandemic, I often answered more fully, hanging in there or okay, even. Fine if it was a day when I felt good. Then, as in before times, I listened for what the question really meant to my patient that day. As the months accumulated, I began to revert to my old answer and say, "Fine." For a new reason. When I heard my patients' voices, I was happy to be with them. I was fine. I felt privileged to do this work. To share space with my patients grounds me. Our lived experience of our world is now divided between pre-pandemic and the emerging post-pandemic. The pandemic has caused a radical and unprecedented revolution in our lifestyles and behavioral patterns. Amy Winehouse's lyrics from Me and Mr. Jones often run through my head. What kind of fuckery is this? Our approaches to life, work, and love have changed in ways that will last. For many of us during the pandemic, we tried to tell ourselves we were fine, but we were not allowing our true feelings to be in the forefront of our minds. The pandemic was a crisis. We were so flooded with feelings and new information that we couldn't even put our full response into words. In the midst of a crisis, we are most focused on managing daily life, not processing what's happening to us. We are, to a certain degree, dissociated. We may feel out of control, overwhelmed, and possibly even numb. Like other collective crises, we will always remember where we were and what we were doing when we first really took in the news that there was a pandemic. I've been following reports of lethal viruses around the world for a long time and had long feared we were overdue for a pandemic. When I first read the news from Wuhan in late January, I was terrified. I felt overwhelmed and helpless. Then I numbed out and told myself it was okay. But just a month later, on the phone with a colleague trying to organize an in-person meeting for a group of us, when my colleague said, We need to take this new virus seriously. I suddenly realized that everything was about to change. The effects of a threat to our well-being last long after the initial danger is over. You are a different person than you were at the beginning of 2020. The way I live and the way I work are altered for the long term. As we faced the cataclysmic impact of the pandemic, many of my patients openly grieved their losses. Some were overwhelmed, almost to the breaking point, by the pressures imposed on them. Nancy found herself homeschooling her 4 children, in addition to building her new business and maintaining the household. Some were cranky and angry about the irretrievable indignities foisted on them. Teresa and Frank could not be with their elderly parents as they suffered their last days of the pandemic in the hospital. Teresa is a neurologist, so this was a double offense for her. One of her core characteristics is that of a caretaker. She prides herself in being there for people and gets especially deep satisfaction out of accompanying people in the gritty, hard, existentially threatening moments. Teresa said goodbye to her mother over the phone. There's a hole in her spirit. Some were delighted that the solitude they've always loved, which had set them apart from others pre-pandemic, was not only sanctioned, but advantageous. Betsy was so relieved about the decrease in social demands. I myself delighted in having more time to myself and with myself. I very much enjoy my own company and always have a long to-do list for pleasure, work, and projects. I developed a newfound friendship, a close and compassionate relationship with myself. I indulged my interests and love of solitude in ways I had never done in the past. Others discovered or rediscovered their most basic priorities in life. Emma realized she didn't need to go to the theater. Ken, Kevin, and Elizabeth all strengthened their resolve to separate from the home fires and forge their adult lives. Some rebelled by flouting the rules of social distancing and mask wearing. Our emotions rolled through us, and still do, as we struggle to make sense of the last many months. One day we feel fine, the next we are battling with the subterranean rumble of despair. Our reactions came in phases during the pandemic. Initially, many felt optimism and energy. I did. After all, how long can a pandemic last? A year? 2 years at the very most. Like the 1918 to 1919 Spanish flu pandemic. I was primed to take this on as a challenge and determined to be positive and adaptive. Then, a phase of weariness set in. Social distancing and hygiene were essential and will likely be some part of our precautionary practice going forward. They take energy. Melancholy lurked right around the corner. The pandemic was not a hoax. The pandemic was a living nightmare. This is the nature of trauma. Survival mechanisms allow us to feel some level of matter-of-fact, some remove, when we are experiencing the utter helplessness caused by traumatic events. It is only afterward, now, that we feel the full force of the impact, that we recognize how we are altered and scarred. I was in survival mode. We emerge slowly from this mentality. At times, I feel positive and can do. In the first months of the pandemic, I had the happy experience that my husband and I bonded more as a couple. For a period, one son and his wife lived with us. My other 2 sons came home more often, and my connection with my husband loosened again to include them, an altered happy circumstance. Some days, I felt demoralized and scared. At bedtime, I have always felt some separation anxiety, a resistance to leaving the world for the night. That anxiety was more pointed during our isolation. I looked for more distraction in the evening. I fought against sleep. Then there were the evenings of an enervating exhaustion. My body felt hollowed out, filled with the entire weight of the pandemic, plus all the other contemporaneous disasters, political, racial, and environmental. Most often, I felt two things at once. There was no either-or. Nothing was binary. We were, and still are, filled with contradictory feelings. For quite a while, I fought off the blueness. Then the blues were unavoidably present. Decades of experience working with patients in therapy has taught me that no good comes of locking out negative feelings for more than a short time. Even our sense of time changed, became less precise. It was difficult for me and others to mark time. There were fewer appointments outside our house or bubble, fewer distinctions between the days. Only my work schedule kept me grounded and tied to a reassuring sense of the correctness of time and place, as opposed to cyberspace. Friends and patients reported that they were experiencing the same phenomenon. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, about life in Auschwitz, Viktor E. Frankl wrote that, in Auschwitz, days lasted forever, but the weeks flew by. The end of many pandemic days surprised me with their small gift of extra time. While the pandemic was certainly not akin to the Holocaust, though for some I recognize that it was a terrible time, I quote Frankl because his words are resonant for the form of captivity we endured. Some people talk about this being a lost year. This is not at all my experience, nor is it the experience of many of the people I interact with, patients, family, and friends. People, myself included, are living intensely, but differently. Even those who are suffering are living. Who says that life is only life when things are going well? Who says that we only live when we are out and about? Suffering is an intense form of living, just not a form we would ever choose. My living this year has taken place within a smaller circumference than pre-pandemic, but it has been no less full and meaningful. I have reveled in my house. My work with my patients has been rich and profound. I have written this book. I have deepened my relationships with a smaller group of family and friends. One son married. Another got engaged. Another formed a close and loving relationship with a woman he had just met prior to COVID. Two of these sons started wonderful new jobs, and the third son polished his abilities in his existing job and is applying to grad school. I could go on, but you get the picture. And last, and possibly the most fruitful meaning I have enjoyed, my internal life and growth have flourished, especially in the opportunity afforded by the absence of my past freneticism. 7 months into the pandemic, I walked into my New York City apartment and into a time warp. I'd left the apartment 5.5 months earlier for my house in the suburbs. Pre-pandemic, I was about to put that suburban house on the market. I thought that part of my life was obsolete. My children were grown and gone. I could return to the city. Everything in my apartment was exactly as I left it, beautiful to my eyes. I spent 17 years in the suburbs and never felt at home. I waited all those years to get back to this apartment in my beloved city. The apartment was a petrified forest, my closet a museum of times past. I picked up a few items to bring back to my house. I wondered whether my clothes will come alive again when the pandemic releases its spell. I love clothes and fashion. I feel pangs of loss. Will my clothes even be relevant or fashionable when the pandemic and recovery are over? For me, clothes have always offered artistic ways we can transform ourselves, even if temporarily. And now, just as our feelings rolled through us in cycles during the pandemic, the period of recovery and the return of a new and altered normal will impact each of us differently. Some will respond by unleashing their pent-up emotions in a new roaring 20s frenzy of social activity, of wearing stilettos and sequins for a Tuesday night movie. Others will be more conservative and will want to wear nothing but sneakers and their pandemic comfy clothes. Yet others will suffer long-term wounds. I love clothes too much to give up the creativity of fashion forever. At the same time, I value comfort more than I did before. My relationship with clothes has evolved and will continue to evolve as we move into the uncertainty of a post-pandemic world. Now in the 12th month of the pandemic, the wheel has turned again. I feel and hear from others a kind of pandemic weariness that is more severe in its tone than ever before. It is different from the weariness I felt before the pandemic. It is the weariness one feels from too much rest and inactivity, from the too little stimulation that comes from sameness, being a homebody, and from yielding to the regression of not putting on one's public face. The past year of sheltering in place has been like a long hibernation. Even though I have been working a lot throughout it all, it has been sublimely restful to work from home, to not commute, travel or oscillate between homes. It is only now that I am feeling the first very faint stirrings of wanting to emerge from my cave, to even imagine putting on full makeup and going to my office. I sense a slight restlessness, at times, a rekindling of my wanderlust. My much-loved travelogues have been calling out to me. I suddenly want to get a mani-pedi. The thawing of this deep sense of hibernated rest illuminates the extent of my past mental fatigue that I had never before realized, especially since I was mostly aware of having high energy. How stretched was I? What kind of toll did this running around exact from me? How will I be different as I emerge into the new world? What I do know is that we are all in this together, therapists and patients alike, this pandemic and this period of recovery. Everyone. Looking out for others' well-being is as important as caring for our own. We all need and deserve each other's empathy. Coincident with the pandemic, we faced unprecedented protests and riots, plus accelerating environmental devastation that may have complicated or intensified our reactions to the pandemic. These events happened without adequate leadership, accentuating our feelings of aloneness and bewilderment. At the beginning of the pandemic and concurrent cluster of worsening events, I hoped that we would rise fully as a society to the call of these circumstances to care for one another. Pundits were talking about the need for more empathy and leadership. Political candidates used words like love, modeling empathy, or so it seemed. We had a unique opportunity to become a more empathic society. We could have used this pandemic to reduce the flagrant narcissism that is so prevalent. With the new Biden-Harris election, we have a shot at it. But the Capitol insurrection, the prevalence of conspiracy theorists, and millions of voters who believe that the Democratic victory was illegal make the work an uphill battle. The jury is out. I had hoped that one of the shifts we would experience in response to the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests, plus devastating wildfires sparked by climate change, was that empathy would be recognized as a critical factor in leadership, in politics, and in policy formation. The historian Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote that President Lincoln's success as a leader and unifier was due in large part to his prodigious empathy and ability to relate to the suffering of the average American. We elected President Biden partially on the basis of his well-recognized empathy. I am waiting to see if his humanity will have a healing effect and influence the sensibilities of the American public. I am hopeful. The strain of extreme anti-empathy in the Trump administration sparked new conversations. That administration's shocking disregard for the suffering and needs of others inspired more people to talk about empathy and take it seriously as a concept. The election of Joe Biden signifies a move in this direction. Is the country's choice of a new leader a seed that will find fertile ground? Or will it fail to germinate? In my work, for the first time during the pandemic, I felt compelled to talk about politics with select patients, because to not do so would have been to ignore the real impact of the unprecedented situation on all our psyches. Politics as usual was no longer the norm. In meeting my patients where they were psychically, I acknowledged that their political angst reflected the reality in which we were all living. Only then could and should I relate it to the particularities of their unconscious, if and when that was relevant to that patient. I'll say more about this later. Traditionally, Americans have been wary of so-called soft concepts like empathy, understanding without judgment, love, soul, and even passion. This suspiciousness can extend to the kind of therapy that I practice, psychoanalytic therapy, which deals with the dynamic unconscious and its dominant influence over our conscious behavior, thinking, and feeling. My work is rooted in psychoanalytic therapy, which is the foundation of all talk therapy. Founded by Sigmund Freud, it offers a consistent, disciplined framework for our work. Sadly, in the U.S., in many ways, Freud's discipline has been turned into a cartoon of its original intent. The rigor was misinterpreted as cold and distant. People unfamiliar with the nuances of our work imagine a therapist with horns who makes their patients lie on a couch without looking at them, rarely speaking to the patient. In the comic book versions of the practice, the work can be heartless and unresponsive to the patient. Few work in this way anymore, and only a few ever did. Over the past decades, there have been many humanizing changes. While it is true that there are restrictive aspects to the practice of psychoanalytic therapy, the core and true spirit of the work is a life-affirming human interaction. Freud's own patients would travel to Vienna, spending months with him, occasionally sharing meals with him. The work, as he practiced it, is, in fact, highly creative and emotional, which is exactly why we need such precise ethical parameters. This sensitive work can get risky when we are mucking around in people's hearts and minds. The potential to harm people is real. To protect against that possibility, Freud spoke out against what he called wild analysis. A good analytical therapist practices with a great sense of responsibility and a do-no-harm ethic. Our conservatism and restraint are baked into our discipline. Over the past few decades, the field of analytic therapy has actively discussed and argued about how to modify and open up our discipline so that the training is perceived as less of a straitjacket. There have been numerous discussions, papers, books, and presentations from a theoretical and clinical standpoint about how we can adapt the work by admitting more of the human aspects of ourselves into the work of therapy. I am personally exploring how we can cultivate more intentional warmth within the evolving parameters of our discipline. I am also a very disciplined person, which is perhaps one of the things that drew me to psychoanalysis in the first place. I tend to be a strict rule follower with a heavy conscience. So I bring to my practice the heritage of psychoanalysis, heightened by my own tendency toward rigor. I have always believed that this is the best way to offer serious therapy. Yet, my barriers have eased. Even before the pandemic, I had become convinced of the need to bring more artistry and more of the therapist's self into the work. The pandemic has tripped the last tumbler, unlocking the final permission I needed to unleash my creativity. Going forward, my charge is to find fresh ways within the enduring analytic framework to offer therapeutic change that enlists more of my intuition, creativity, and humanness. In other words, more empathy. I hope that empathy, which is at the foundation of good therapy, will be appreciated as a value in the wider world and in our most intimate relationships. The world is ready for such change. The foundations are shaken. I am reinventing myself in my work and in my life. My colleagues feel this impulse toward change, too. This book is a chronicle of what it was like to practice therapy in the time of the contemporary pandemic that COVID is. The challenges I encountered during this strange and unique time in history, as well as my observations of both my patients and my own reactions. Then I will delve into the practical details and nuances of how the therapist's craft needed to change and will continue to change. Wrapped up in these shifts is my own evolution as a therapist and as a person. Preserving the therapist's unique role as interpreter of the unconscious is a constant in my work. The ways in which we can be helpful in that role require rethinking, even transformation. Threaded through the professional and societal narrative in this book are the personal details of how the pandemic unleashed a new creativity and artistry in my work. I was on the runway pointed toward a new way of working before the pandemic. During the pandemic, I took off. Now I have no intention of landing anytime soon. I will share my ideas and suggestions for ways to navigate the positive and negative impacts, as well as the potential long-term shifts that will inform our practices for years to come. My ideas, of course, are all filtered through the lens of my own personal reflections on our new reality and how I am changing, personally and professionally. Of course, this book is not just about therapy. After all, life and therapy cannot be separated, because therapy is nothing if not a profoundly human endeavor. Here, on the other side of this pandemic, is a world transformed. In these chapters, I want to share what I'm seeing of our future through my patients, my practice, and my life. A new clinical situation. The therapy profession had to deal with the twin issues of a real medical threat and the advent of exclusively remote sessions. Carol initially brought up the possibility of taking a walk together for our sessions, but we never did. She was either uninterested or at least avoidant of the topic she had raised. 11 months after the start of the pandemic, none of my colleagues were seeing patients in person yet either. Patients and therapists alike are impacted by these massive shifts. Can we therapists fill the role of partner in crisis and post-crisis recovery and be a guide at the same time? This is our new challenge, to be more of a partner to our patients than we have been in the past, yet still being our patients' guides down into their unconscious. We must accommodate their practical issues, even as we have to integrate those realities into the analytic work of the unconscious. As never before, we need to come up to the surface at times to meet our patients where they are. We need to find the new balance between surfacing and diving down into the less conscious layers whenever possible. We need to learn to parse the real from the psychic in a new way, to respect what is concrete or literal, a category that has taken on a whole new importance and context than it did before the pandemic. Like working with people who are dealing with the very real privations and insults caused by physical illness, old age, and poverty. The pandemic made the real world more present in every therapy session. The work of therapy can potentially be richer and deeper as it acquires an intense edge, forged by the extraordinary conditions of this crisis we share with our patients, and which will reverberate for some years beyond the end of the pandemic. Like those who lived through the Great Depression, we who lived through the pandemic will be forever imprinted by its urgency. I experienced an increased sense of intimacy with virtually all my patients as we adapted and moved forward together through the crisis, as just two real people. I felt, and continue to feel, a pull to discuss practical matters with patients. Sometimes I talk with them about what I think of as a we matter, that is, challenges we all face. Other times, the practical point of discussion is a you matter, pertaining specifically to that patient. Practical can be appropriate, especially during the pandemic and the recovery period. At the same time, I still believe that we therapists must be parsimonious about it. The practical discussions I engage meet patients where they are.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?